We're going to deal a little longer with the free market from last week. It is one of the basic issues, maybe not even the basic issue of free market, but it is a very important one, and one we need to understand. I also wonder out there, you and everybody else out there, how much of the material we talk about here has ever been covered in school or college, high school? Probably not. And really makes me wonder why not, because it is basic information we need on how we raise our family, how we teach them to be responsible, and what God expects of us as individuals. And I was talking to somebody, is he here today? He had some economics background and didn't get a real clear answer. So maybe you're going to be really privileged now to hear stuff that you don't hear at the university, which I think is probably going to be true, because they're probably not going to teach conservative economics, which I guess this would be what it is, because anything out of the Bible is really probably conservative. All right, so this is the second part of the free market economy. So we have, again, these opening statements so we understand what we're saying in case somebody's not been here. We have explained why the world is the way it is, its meanness, by these five events. First of all, we noted that the world is not a safe place because of the four judgments of God that puts us in the environment of evil, harmful, shameful, and unequal trials. Things good and bad are going to randomly happen to good and bad individuals. Humans are uniquely gifted as individuals who have various opportunities and outcomes, nor are they equal or the same. We start out different, we end up different. It's a lot more fun that way, frankly. Any attempt to disregard these realities, act like they don't exist, will only add greatly to the despair of human existence, no matter how well they are. Something we have these little phrases, unintended consequences, that fits here. So a good idea with disastrous result is really not a good idea at all. It's a horrible idea. And we know that our politicians promise a better tomorrow, or else they wouldn't get elected, I guess, or relief from God's judgment, but they are incapable of eliminating it or even ameliorating it. They only pile on new levels of misery, but poverty continues in spite of the wealth spent to alleviate it. They disregard the Genesis mandate. If it comes out of the Bible, it's off the table. We don't mix the Bible with the secular world, they would say. So they disregard the mandate and choose rather the ideas of an anti-God, the anti-God evolutionists. We call those the materialists, because to them everything is just material. When God cursed the earth, remember, due to the fall, it is expected that the world would become an unfriendly place. God didn't say that particularly, but we've noticed that by watching it. Christians, however, do not despair in the face of this reality, but find in it a way of praising God. And I'll have one example of that for you this evening. In any case, Christians know that the judgments do not change the Genesis mandate, which is the general and operational instruction for the entire human race, not just for the Christians. It fits the Buddhists and the Hindus and the Jews and the Christians and the atheists. All are under this instruction. The resources to accomplish this will come from the earth. We'll talk about that in lessons to come. The materials come out of the earth. And from using the mind, the creative capacities that God has given us, which is really a characteristic of God himself. It is maligned by the materialist creationists who believe that the events are just random, especially when they're bad events, or controlled, they must control it so good things happen, by a central planning agency. Just good just won't happen by itself. You have to help it. The goal is equality for those in a managed economy. So I have left Your left hand is the managed economy. The free economy is on the right. My little model. Remember how we talked about this last week? If you talk your idea into the microphone, whatever the idea is, it'll move the needle one way or the other. And the needle will probably not go all the way with one particular idea, but they accumulate. So one idea is a top of another idea, and that moves the needle another notch, another notch, and another notch. So sometimes we think, well, it's only a small notch. But when you add up all the notches, you can go a long way, much further than you might think. Okay, now it says that the goal is equality for those in a managed economy. Well, equality, yes, but a little more for those who do the managing. There is no way to stop this urge to control from sliding into despotism and tyranny. Cannot be done. Once you get a hold of a little power, what is it? Power corrupts absolutely. Our example has been Marxism to Lenin to Stalin. Stalin gave up on the benevolent ideas of Marxism, which is probably an oxymoron, but gave him the best ideas. You know, Marx thought that after communism or socialism would come no government. No government. And so when Stalin continued to promote his centralized government, he shot his, I was going to bring his name, forgot his name, that was a contender for the office of chairman when Lenin died. He shot him because he dared challenge Stalin because he was not giving up the control of the government, which he should have, because that was the next stage of communism. So Stalin gave up the benevolent ideas of Marxism and became a tyrant, and lasted for 25 years, so 1953. Since the materialists, I mean, that's those are the evolutionists, manage much of the public institutions, the public schools, all practices of government, I guess all, that's not the right word there, all forms of government. There are no Christian governments out there, right? So they're all atheistic or they're secular without God. I have to say, even some churches are now promoting these ideas, and most of the media. So there's little time remains to learn about what God has given, about the God-given plan of freedom in the market. Good churches generally do not deal with the subject since it seems too political. I've mentioned that to you, and I've been careful how I have taught this class. Yet there are matters of right and wrong that must be understood and taught our children so that they learn duty and responsibility with an understanding of what God expects of them. If we don't teach it here, they're not going to get it out there. Well, this is sort of an embarrassing thing. Pastors teaching economics is like eunuchs teaching about sex. Did it take a little while to catch that? Okay. It's all right. It's a slow evening. No serious Christian writing about natural science would ignore the basic facts of chemistry or astronomy. But many Christian leaders feel free to ignore the basic facts of economics. Now, this is a serious mistake because economics is just not a bundle of baseless opinions by politicians. Now, we have to agree that there is politics. I think that's the right verb, is politics in economics. And economics are social realities. But they're co-opted by the philosopher politicians. In other words, they've taken what God has said and changed it. Teaching Bible economics. Unusual for a pastor? Well, perhaps, but it should be the theologians who first understand Scripture and then specialize in a discipline of physics, chemistry, history, and economics. If an advanced study in a science discipline occurs first, it is hard to keep the science out of the theology. And we had that case in our psychological mix-up in 1987 and 1989. Some of you were around when you saw that. That's what happened there. Scientists in the past, and I picked just Newton, there are others, Galileo and a bunch of others, were theologians first, then scientists. Then, with the acknowledgement of a consequential God, they looked into his creation and discovered the science. That's the right order. Now, I don't know how we're ever going to get this straightened out because we don't have time to do both, it seems like. By the time you got the theology down, you don't have time to go do something else. So you spend all your time in one or the other, and it seemed like we have a problem. So anyway, we're going to make the attempt to start out with theology and then move to economics, and that's how I have approached everything I teach. We start with the Bible and we go somewhere else. See how it affects it. Now, I had to be educated this evening by my own family. So we have farm fresh vegetables, honey, and free-range eggs. And I did not know what a free-range egg was. You all do? Oh, good grief. Then I'm not even going to say what it is, because if you don't know, then just be embarrassed. What is it? All right, good. It's an egg that's laid by chicken that doesn't live in a coop. And those somehow are better. I don't know what, how they know that, because there's no God that would have designed a chicken to run around outside without a coop. They're three times as expensive. So that makes them better, right? I think we have a little lesson to learn tonight about this stuff. So, all right, so we know what free-range eggs are. If you don't know anything else, get anything else out of the lesson today. Huh? Yeah, they're called pigeon eggs. Okay, last week we talked about the God-given underpinning of our free market assumptions. We won't do that again, and we could spend a lot more time on it. In fact, every Bible passage talks about an economy, even to the point of Abraham buying land for Sarah. There's a whole economic lesson in that. So as we don't have time for everything, we won't have time for that either. But maybe someday we'll come back and work on that. Okay, so it's our subject because we began this unit last week with the two essentials necessary to have a biblical economy. I have a little for sale, house for sale here. That is a free market thing. You decide to put the sign out there. And I even got one that said, by the owner. You could have by real estate person too. That would work. Now, there are complementary factors. One cannot exist without the other. As in biology, a symbiotic relationship exists between freedom to act voluntarily, to buy and to sell whatever you have, and to come and go wherever you want to go, and the ownership of private property. An added essential is the agency, or a government, usually in our case, strong enough to protect the rights of property and the freedom to manage, that is, to buy and sell it without coercion. And I remind you that your address at your house is, in a sense, a legal description of your property. You can have another way of describing it, but there's no two addresses alike in the same city, right? To make sure that doesn't happen. From our foundation of our understanding, we move to failed historical experiments. The 20th century was one big lab experiment for the economic theories of the 18th and the 19th century, and the French Revolution fits in that period. The results of that experiment are in. And I'm quoting a lot from Jay Richards in his book, Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. I'm quoting from a lot of his stuff. The result of that experiment are in. It's time for the theologians, Christians, to take an honest look at the economic facts and get acquainted with the free market system. And he used the word capitalism. I don't like capitalism. Because capitalism to me is a pejorative. I mean, after all, what is capital except equity? So we have an equity system. But a free market much better describes what we're talking about than just the word capitalism. Since Karl Marx came up with it, I refuse to use it. So communism is out. We've agreed to that, except we're down to five nations left now that are actually run by communists. Yet the free market is not in. So we ask some questions that we may want to keep in our minds. Why is the system that brings freedom so denigrated? Why does the system that enslaves and kills and continue to capture the hearts of the enslaved? Why is freedom such a hard sell? It seems like it'd be the easiest thing in the world to sell. Well, I suggest that it expects personal responsibility and the care of a providential God. Those two things make it difficult to stomach. That I have to be responsible, and that I am responsible to somebody. So the grand experiment, we talked about Russia. Russia was forced against the will of the people to adopt communism in 1918, the October Revolution. The economy was instantly destroyed when the cropland was taken from the farmers. With that, the destruction of the free market. Under the policies of the Marxist-Leninist socialists, the farmlands, the crops, the housing, the cows, the sheep, the horses, the grain. Everything was confiscated and redistributed to workers. Some of them, and most of them, had never farmed in their life. There was a total collapse of the economy in one growing season. Remember, it was so bad, thousands, millions of people starved, and they had to come up with a new economic plan about 1922. Well, as you know, I have ancestors that came from the Ukraine, and they're very strongly in the news these days again, and I've been reading this diary of Anna Wiebe. And she lived in this time when Lenin came to power. They lived in Russia. They were married in 1911, and they left in 1922. So they were actually, through both revolutions, living in Russia. And she kept a diary, which has now been reproduced, and so I'm going to just share a little bit of it with you. This is the diary of Anna Wiebe, having fled Russia on hearing what happened to their farm. Writing this, she is now in Germany, or actually it's in Prussia, on the Polish-German border area with Germany. It is, who knows what border was. I know there were borders close there in the Vistula River Delta. She writes, and I love the way she writes. She likes like a, I'd say it this way. I love the way she writes, and she writes like a woman. I mean that in a nice way, because she writes with the emotion of the that you might miss where the men would write it, all right? So she writes, with heavy, heavy heart, we receive the message today that our lovely home in Russia is taken over by the communists. Now we are lost. Now we have lost it forever. Sieberts, now the family, the people that were in our house were evicted. Sister Anna and Johannes, that's a brother-in-law, and the neighbors came and helped them move out. They could only take those things that the communists had not listed as their property. The communists wanted to prepare the house for their own use. Oh, how that gave us pain. Why? Is it possible that they are still persecuting Jacob, her husband, and trying to harm him in every way they can? And he was a Christian. Shall we never see our lovely home again, our home where we spent 10 wonderful, happy years? Shall we never see those rooms again? Shall we never work there again? Oh, Lord, thou dost lead us through such dark ways. Is there more punishment, more blows that we should get? No. We will be still and thank the Lord for all the good, all the blessings that he has bestowed upon us. Now, Jacob had fled earlier, and so now they are together again as a family. And she was by way of German descent, so she could actually leave Russia because of that. And they immigrated to Prussia. She goes on, same day. Oh, how thankful we are that Jacob is now safe. And the children and I can be here with them in our parents' house and don't have to witness the pillage of our house, our home, and watch the ruthless destruction of the things that our parents had so lovingly built up for us. And you, sister-in-law, Anna, her husband's sister, had to watch with heavy heart, and she's still living there, with heavy heart, the devastation. And the Sieberts had the pain of being ordered out of their home. It was a big loss for them, as many things were taken from them. And the Sieberts moved in with the Bergmans, and some of the things that they could save from our house were taken to the neighbors. Then she ends, oh, the painful thought to know that we are now beggars. Be quiet, but quiet, dear heart. God is still our guide. He knows what is best for us. He knows how to make this tragedy a blessing for us. So we have two things here. We see an experience of a person in Soviet Russia, and we also see a believer in Russia and how they handle it. Okay, so these things were really personal for people. They really did affect them. Now, this person didn't die, but she had two children that did because of the flight. They just couldn't survive, little babies. So anyway, all that to say, Russia's socialism has been an absolute disaster. And by the way, here's a picture of their farm. You see, it's quite nice. Okay, communism is out, but free market economies are still denigrated. But history's harsh verdict on communism has not led to a warm Christian embrace of the free market. Now, this man writes quite broadly about Christians. On the contrary, we are told that the free market destroys our natural resources and the moral environment. So they say it's a dog-eat-dog world. We hear this on television and in newsprint, of course, but we also hear it in churches and Bible studies. I must quickly add, I hope not in our church. But we talk about churches that are liberal. I'm sure you hear this. In fact, you were talking to me about somebody was coming to speak in the church in Omaha that was fiercely anti-Semitic, and they would probably be very, very supportive of some of the socialist ideas. So church-going business people, going on with the quote here, church-going business people endure sermons that show little understanding of business. Many thoughtful Christians suffer pangs of doubts, and I would suggest reading Christianity Today for the flavor of this uncertainty. It certainly is there. Or they feel vaguely guilty, even when their experience contradicts what they hear from the pulpit. We hear about business ethics as if business had unique moral hazards not encountered in law or medicine or education or in ministry. Somehow, economy is sort of a different thing. So we asked last week, can we build a just society? And we answered that no, no one can build a utopia. It is a false socialistic claim. We are all living under the constraints of God's judgment because all are sinners, just as the Bible has said. But we have said that any attempt to build a just, whatever that means, society with the body politic ruling will be a disaster for the entire creation and Christianity in particular. And we saw this in Russia, and it was repeated in China and elsewhere, wherever socialism has been tried. So we live in a dangerous world and so forth. We come down to number four. A free market economy is God-given, I believe. I think it was in the DNA of Adam as he was created, and thus the best of all systems. It benefits all mankind, but it can never give birth to a utopia since sin has eviscerated that possibility. I think it will come, but it will come in the millennium. A free market depends on personal freedom to make personal choices, and ownership and secure private property is essential to freedom and a free economy. So last week we had the free market economy is not perfect. It is only better than any other economy. And that's kind of the way we have to explain this. But we still have questions. How does it work? Does it not hurt people? Will not the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? Is not the free market an opportunity to extort wealth from the laborer? Well, the second point here is the free market economy helps everyone, not just the rich, and it doesn't stamp on the poor. I can never do this because the group's too big, but we're going to act like we're at kindergarten this evening, and live the life of a kindergarten with this little illustration. So you are my students. Anyway, there are 24 students in the class. See if you don't react to the thing the same way these kids did. There are 24 students in the class, boys and girls. The teacher brings 24 items to class. Each is different, but each was purchased for $1 at the local dollar store. The students write down on a piece of paper their ranking on a scale from 1 to 10, how much they liked their gift. For dollar, I don't know what you could write down there, but anyway, that's what to write down. They were not to talk to each other. The teacher adds up the score. Now, we just have a few kids doing this. Didn't I say 8? Didn't say that. Now, next, the teacher... No, that's everybody does it. Sorry. Now, the teacher divides them up of the 24 into 3 groups of 8. There we go. In each group of 8, each is given the choice to keep what he has, what they got, or trade with another group member within the group. One boy got a stack of Barbie trading cards. And a girl got a ball with a paddle with a rubber cord attached, one of those. They traded their toys, and so did most of the rest of the 8 in the group. Some ended up keeping the original gift. You were not forced to give it up. Again, the teacher asked the students on a scale on 1 to 10 to rank how much they liked their new possession. Again, the teacher added up the scores. Guess what? Aggregate score went up. Now the teacher said that everyone could trade with the whole group of 24. All the kids came out of their shell and began to bargain. Can you imagine the pandemonium? For a better gift than they had. They could trade and retrade until everyone was satisfied that they had the gift they wanted or could get. The score was taken again, and it went even higher. Result of the free market in a Petri dish is that almost everyone ended up with a toy that he liked more than the one he started with. No one had a score that had gone down. The only kids whose score didn't go up were the ones who happened to get gifts they really liked and didn't trade them. Or the one that got the gift that you could trade with anybody. So it kind of, you know, couldn't trade with anybody anyway. So those are the two that didn't trade. So now let's think back about this a little quickly. So did it hurt people? Did it hurt anybody in the class? In the kids? Did any of the kids get hurt? We said no. Did the rich get richer? Well, yes, but not really. But if they did, how? They didn't take anything from anybody, did they? Did the poor get poorer? Well, no. Maybe they're poor to start out with, but they didn't get poorer. No one got poorer. If anything, everybody got a better gift. At least they thought it was better. Was this free market an opportunity to extort wealth? No, not really. Did all get the trade? Likely all did. Those who did not get the best deals, since those that did not got the best deal since they did not want to trade. Those that got the worst, hypothetical, maybe there was somebody, deal did not get to trade. So those are the choices. So let's walk through these issues. First of all, trading freely can add value even though traded items remain physically unchanged. Got it? Just note this phenomenon. Value score for the gifts in the aggregate rose after these exchanges, twice. Once the small group and more pronounced in the larger group. Number two, normally when trading freely, the more trading partners there are, the better. At the end of trading, most scored their gifts higher, even though nothing was added to the gift to make them more valuable. They all start out worth a dollar. At least they bought them for a dollar. The chance of getting a bigger gift goes up if the pool of gifts is bigger. Selling your used smartphone on the internet has more upside potential than selling it at the garage sale. So the larger the number of market participants, the better. And then we enter advertisements, because there we get bigger market yet. Did you ever watch the Mikum? How do you say that? Mikum. Have you ever watched the Mikum auto auctions? The widest audience is needed to sell these rare cars at a good price. You had your 1955 Chevy convertible, which is my favorite car, which I'll never own, and got three people show up to buy it. Not a good thing, you know, unless he had a lot of money, you know. But then it's not going to get bid up because no one's going to bid against him. All right, the bigger, the better. Number three. Now, the free exchange is a win-win situation. There are three kinds of games. There's a win-lose, where one wins. There's a lose-lose, where no one wins. And there's a win-win, when everyone wins. Which would you like? I think in poker, I never played poker, but I think there's one that wins in poker. Is that how that works out? I don't think you ever divvy up your winnings with the rest of the gang. So the win-lose, one wins. We are used to this arrangement in sports. One team wins, another loses. There are victors and there are those that are defeated. This is accepted in sports and in poker and a few other places. This is a zero-sum contest. Winners take it all. A lose-lose, no one wins. We don't see much of this since everyone is humiliated or dead. Like the old game of chicken. Remember the chicken game? I never did it with the cards. I was too chicken to play chicken. There was rarely a winner and most of them were losers. But a win-win is where everyone wins. The outcome may not be 50-50, but both are winners, at least better off than they were. This is a positive sum game where there's value added, as we saw in our kindergarten lesson one today. A win-win exchange is free on both sides, in which no one, win-win exchange is free on both sides, in which no one is forced or tricked into participating. Very important issue here, this issue of being coerced, tricked, or forced, or tempted, or teased, or baited. Because as soon as that happens, the free market ceases to exist. So in the schoolroom, the trading ended with most everyone with something of higher value. As a result, as a result. Was that something that remained? Okay, that's a wrong sentence too. But the value of it remained the same. It was the same thing, but the value of it went up. So I'm trying to say. It remained the same thing in the same place in the eyes of the same people. Yet the value went up. So we've got to warn ourselves a little bit here. A win-win situation, there must be rules set up beforehand so that everyone can do what they want without coercion, being forced, tricked, be lied to, and so forth. The participants must be free to exchange or not to exchange. Free to act is essential in a free market system. If there is a bully in the room and he takes what he wants, the free market has not been established because it was tilted by an outside element. Very important that these free markets are absolutely left alone. Or else we're going to go one way or the other on the slide. Which way is it going to go? If it's going to go that way, it's going to be managed. It's going to go that way. It has to go that way. It can't go this way because this side is freedom. If you take away freedom, you're going to go that way. Okay, this leads to the next essential. Rules must be observed. Number four, rules to live by. This necessitates an outside enforcer. Fairness is playing by the rules set up beforehand based on biblical standards for right and wrong. So fairness here is tied to something, not just fair without any root. The teacher in the room was the enforcer of the rules. If the rules were not observed, the cheater would be removed with the result of just one less trading partner. That's all would happen. Yeah, no big deal, just one guy's gone. You know, we're not 23 trading partners. In ordinary life, many things act as enforcers. We have the government, we have public pressure, we have churches, we have teachers, parents, lawyers, and, of course, the fear of God keeps us on track. Now, scarcity is almost always real. If all the toys the teacher passed out were the same, there would be no trading, would there be? Because there would be no scarcity. We all had the same thing. Trading becomes necessary when there's a scarcity of things. Now, except for air, almost everything is scarce. Except here, if you're underwater, I thought. Well, then it's pretty scarce. That is, it is not free for the taking and not available in unlimited amounts. So everything has got some limits except air, and maybe we can't say water, because there are places on the earth there's not water. Where there is scarcity, there is competition. Oh, and I got to be a little humorous here. If there's one good look of woman in the room full of men, what do you think? Competition heats up. But then we say all is fair in love and lore. Okay, so some lessons. The basic options are a win-lose society based on the law of the jungle. Not good. Lose-lose society is of course, socialism. We've seen this. You know, Russia didn't win with this. Even though they thought they did, they didn't win with this. The people didn't win with it. The country didn't win. It was a lose-lose situation. Socialism is a lose-lose situation. So what we're looking for is a win-win free market is the best possible. The right rules can make the trading game win-win, even when there is scarcity. Opportunity cost. All right, when there's scarcity, there's always a trade-off. Living down in, watching Casa down in Brazil live, back in the days when we went down to visit them all the time, they were living in a highly inflating economy. And everything was scarce down there. And everything didn't worry about what something cost, because if it was available, you bought it, no matter what the price. Because tomorrow it wouldn't be available. Talk about scarcity and what it does to the price of something. It's incredible. Inflation does that. So when there's scarcity, there's always a trade-off. In the trading game, no one gets to have more than one toy. In the real world, if I have only 10 grand, I can pick any other number. I can't buy both a used car and a grand piano. I got to choose. I have to choose one or the other. And that, in a sense, while I evaluate the trade-offs, in a sense, it determines what something costs. Trading can make me better off than I was before, but it can't give me everything. So there is a limit to what trading can do. Number seven, economic value is in the eye of the beholder. This is the foundational issue, the rock over which Marx and Lenin and their ilk tripped. There was confusion for centuries about just what establishes the price of something. Not surprising, the principles are quite simple. But the analysis of what happens is more difficult, and much ink has been spread in defense of various theories used to determine the value, cost, price of something. Well, some thought of price as something as the value of the labor that went into the product. Add the hours times the hourly rate, voila, the price is established. That was Lenin's approach. In all places, in all times, in all seasons, in all for all products. You got to shake your head already, don't you? But this is a viable idea. But it does not work that way, Mr. Lenin. Too bad Marx and Lenin did not know that. It would have saved millions of lives, hundreds of millions plus lives. Who said small mistakes can make big differences? I did. What was the small error of Marxism? It still operates in the bogus system to determine value. Counting the cost to establish the value may seem reasonable, but it is wrong. Just like Limited Atonement, I thought. By the way, Gil's sermon on Sunday night on Limited Atonement was outstanding. If you didn't get it, get it. So Limited Atonement, you get there by logic, not by theology. Okay. So we need some examples. Do houses get priced based on the number of hours needed to finish it? Think about that. Have you ever seen a new car window sticker say how many hours were needed to build it and at what rate was used to establish the price? Now, we're not in the socialist system. That's why you don't see it on the window. But if you were Karl Marx, that's what you'd have to do. You'd have to put so many hours, so many people worked on it, so many dollars an hour. Of course, they're all paid the same. And that cost, that market, that price, that car was priced at that value. So I ask you, some of you that are hobbyists, do you keep track of your hours to make the what's it for thing and price it accordingly? If you did that, you'd either sold it right away because it was way too cheap, which you probably didn't do, or you still own it. Probably you still own it because the hours you put into it will never get your value out of it, right? I remember building stick model airplanes thinking, I can never sell this for what it's worth. I have way, way too many hours in it. So you spend something that paid maybe $300, $400, $500 dollars worth of hours in it. No one's going to pay you that for it. So it just sat there, hung on my ceiling. All right, labor and price or value. Of course, there must be some correlation between the cost of labor and the price value of a product. I mean, that goes into the thing. My neighboring house, for example, was built with more and more goodies. This is a true story. Needing more and more hours to complete. It has still not sold to this day, now 8 years later. Yeah, this man, a new builder, did not think to limit the labor, his labor and material cost. I'll just keep on building, and whenever I'm done, I'll just add up what I got in it and add my profit to it, and I'll sell it. He just set the price to cover the cost of these materials and maybe a little profit, maybe too much profit, I don't know. But then he priced his house out of the market. It costs more money to build than it was worth. Two choices, and he has to hold it and hope that the market will catch up and sell and take a loss. You know what he's doing? He's holding on to it. He's got a ways to go. So labor often adds value to a product, no doubt about that, as long as that labor creates something more of what somebody else wants. But you can't define economic value in terms of labor. But the cost of labor may be a decider whether you will make the thing or not. Someone can dig a ditch in the field until his hands are bloody and raw and then fill it back in again without anything and without making anything anybody wants. What's that worth? Or a buried treasure can be where he's digging. Then we have all kinds of men standing there ready to dig. It may be women do. But digging a hole and filling it up, that itself is no value, unless you're an army, they told me. So Marx's biggest blunder, Marx's prophecy, was that capitalism would destroy itself hinged on his labor theory of value. That's where he would figure out that the people, the workers in the factories, figure out what was going on. They'd rise up in revolution and throw out the owners, and that's what they thought. Didn't happen. Remember, revolution did not come in England where he thought it would because of this reason. But according to Marx, when a factory owner hires a worker to build a chair and then sells that chair for more than it costs to produce, the owner has taken more than the good is actually worth. He's taken its surplus value. Such profit is basically theft, he said, since, on Marx's term, the chair was worth exactly what it costs to produce. So the factory owner has gotten more than it's really worth. This is why Marx speaks of capitalists exploiting workers, even if the workers have chosen to work for the salary they are given. I just wonder, how in the world does this Marx ever figure that anybody would build a factory where it was a break even for the owner? I mean, talk about self-interest. The self-interest, I'm not going to do it. And therefore, there are no jobs. Now, millions of Christians still, this is quoting here yet, millions of Christians still don't get economics for the same reason. They compare the high salary of business owners who bear the risk, or the CEO who may make decisions worth many millions of dollars, with the lower salary of an employee, and sure assume that somebody's getting the shaft. Not my word. It's a fraud, said Jim Wallace, and he's a very lefty guy and a Christian type. Not really a Christian, I don't think. It's a fraud when the average CEO of the Standard & Poor's 500 company makes $13 million in a total compensation in 2005, while the minimum wage worker makes $10,000. How does he know that? Unless the worker lied or is forced to work or the CEO lied about his record, there is no fraud here. Everyone has freely chosen to work for their wages. Of course, some of those workers may have limited choices. Training, strength, intelligence, opportunity. All that's regrettable, but it's not fraud. We just had this lesson in my class a couple of weeks ago, Matthew 19:13-14. After paying the different workers the same rate, no matter how long they work for them, Jesus says to the people that worked all day long and got the same rate, he says, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for one denarius? Well, they'd have to say, well, yes, we did. But since those other guys got the same and they only worked an hour, I thought maybe we should get more. You agreed to it, Jesus says. Economic principle. So economic value is not only in the eye of the beholder. The beholder's eyes can see things differently in different circumstances. I value the same glass of water much more if I'm hot and thirsty and miles from any other water than I'm sitting in my air-conditioned kitchen where I can get a glass of water anytime I want. See, these things have a factor on what something is worth. So it's practically free. That is what water is. In contrast to a painting by Van Gogh, which no one really needs, and is still very expensive. Part of the reason is because the paintings are scarce, unlike water. You can't get a Van Gogh free from the Dutch Impressionist dispenser at the department store. I didn't write that. But that's not the whole story. Van Goghs aren't only scarce, they're desired. Lots of people coughed up a lot of serious bucks to get them. Now, Adam Smith, who held to an on and off again labor theory of value, struggled to resolve this paradox in his book Wealth of Nations, a classic. It seems like a paradox if you're looking for economic value in the wrong place. But it's not a paradox once you realize that economic value has to do with how much I and lots of other people value the goods and services in the marketplace, how I value with my other friends. To say economic value is subjective, which it is not to say that it's relative like in postmodernism where spiritual things are subjective. No, we're talking about something in economics. And there it is, subjective. What I'll pay for something is different than what you'll pay for something. One more thing on value. Say that house A, the pinky, stinky house that really looks bad, costs $500,000 because that's how much it costs to build. Big house, lots of money. And they say the labor theory of value is the law of the land. Then, for the developer to receive a just price for the house, he must receive $500,000. According to Marx, plus no profit since profit extorts the labor. Don't know how he can do this. But what if no one wants to pay that much for the house? Then the only way for him to get his just price is for someone to be forced to pay that price, whether the person likes it or not, or to be coerced to buy it with low down payment, low interest rate, or a long payback period, and not least, in other words, they have a government guarantee on the loan for the investor. Make a lot of mistakes in my stuff today. Anyone remember the housing crash starting in 2006? That's what happened. That's not a win-win situation. The government didn't win, the country didn't win, the people didn't win, we all lost. But it was a win for the situation, for the developer, and a big fat loss for the new, reluctant, coerced homeowner. And eventually it would be a loss to the entire country. For years, people owed more on their houses than for what they could be sold for. They were underwater, they said. The government did a little to help, but delayed the inevitable with big losses to taxpayer money. Again, the economy suffered because of it. In our pre-2006 society, developers could build whatever they wanted. And that was kind of where my neighbor's house was, or the house in my neighborhood was. It was in that 2004, 2005 period. You could build anything you want, and you could sell it. Well, they got caught in this big bubble, they call it. In the pre-2006 society, developers could build whatever they wanted, spend as much as they wanted, ignore what other people wanted, or better could afford, or what they could afford. They could even hire lazy, lying workers and get fully compensated because the coercion of the government to guarantee the loans, no matter what the risk. Redlining, poor risk buyers were included in the market, but they could not afford the houses. Many went into foreclosure again to a great loss to the economy. This was a loss situation again. They hardly any resemblance of a free economy, or at least if there was a loss, even in this case, the builder didn't get it because he was the owner and the buyer, or the owner and the builder. He now is the owner, reluctantly. So a forced market based on market theory of value would lead directly to a crummy housing system. It sounds like an academic fantasy. Go out and check the housing development built under the Soviet Union. I showed you a picture of that. And they make stinky houses look pretty good. Let's dispense with a forced housing market based on a bogus theory of value and free things up a bit. If the developer can't make or coerce you to buy his house, what's he going to do? He's going to be more careful to build houses that people will freely buy. He's going to think about what people want and can't afford rather than what he wants to build. He's going to look for ways to build houses below the price people are willing to pay. If he can, by his creative genius, do this, there will be a legitimate, not extorted profit for his family. If he does this well, he may get fabulously rich, but his customers should not begrudge him or his wealth because they got something that they wanted more than the money they had, and they gave that money to him and they got the house. They should thank him for the service, which without it, they would still be without a home. The builder would not have to work. In that case, the dreaded lose-lose situation would occur. So this comes to employment, jobs, and so forth. I'm going to skip this because it's the same idea about jobs, the pays for that. So we saw in our Petri dish, the kindergarten, it is a picture of the true world. We need a monetary system that allows me to trade with my neighbor when he doesn't have something of equal value. Currency tied to some accepted value becomes the medium of exchange. If he has one cow and I have 100 cabbages, we can still do business with money. The value of cabbages and cows can be established much like the point system in the first kindergarten illustration, but they will never be stable prices for all and all times and all places. They will fluctuate. Now, not everything or skill is valued the same. Now, this is important when you talk about our young people. What are you going to get trained to do? The idea to follow your dream is fine if you know that there's a market for the product of your dreams. Your dream may be to paint junky watercolors. You may like them, and your mother might act like she likes them, but no one else does, so you're in the poorhouse. The axiom, follow the dreams that are worth something to somebody else, besides your mother, whose house is full of them already. And the more you appeal to, the better it is. Okay, so what defines a free market? This is our last panel. We're done. What defines a free market? This leads us the bridge into the next lesson. If it's not even competition or private property or the pursuit of rational interest, self-interest, it's this idea of wealth to be created. The implementation of these three items are essential, but the heart of free market economy lies elsewhere. We know that free market economies work because they allow wealth to be created rather than remaining a fixed size. That's something that you hear all the time. The pie is not a size that we all divide up. The pie gets bigger when we do the thing we did in the kindergarten classes. And then we have a way to create wealth. And countries that do not create wealth will continually be poverty-stricken. And no matter how much money you send to them, that basic system that caused them to be in poverty has not been fixed. But I think in the end, what the socialists have done to make themselves successful, of those 24 people in the class, let's say they all traded something for made a better trade for themselves. They got something like better than they got to begin with, except two. Let's say those two. They were stuck, weren't they? They were stuck. I hate my toy. No one else wants my toy, but I'm stuck with my toy. So the socialist says, he's the guy we're going to pick on. We're going to help him establish his rights to raise up. And we go against the system. So remember I said, we live in a dangerous world. There are some winners. There are some losers. In this class of 24, somebody's going to be a loser. And it could be me. It could be you. Now, when we as Christians see that, say, well, that's where I am. I've had reversals. This lady from Russia, they had quite a set of reversals there. They left. They tell you everything. They not only did they lose their farm and all their product, they took their clothes with them. And the railroad station, as they're waiting for the train to come, they stole all her clothes, the baggage. I mean, so they ended up having nothing. She had nothing to wear except what she had on her back. And then on the train, her dress got burned, a hole in it, so they had to patch her dress. I mean, you talk about losing everything, and she says, I'm still going to praise the Lord. See, now that's what we have to do as believers, but the unbeliever can't do that. So he looks for a way to better his position, and if somebody can help him out of his hole, a politician, that becomes fair trade for him. Well, we live in a relatively free country yet. And as Gil preached Sunday night, we live in a country where we have freedom to assemble and have this discussion, whether it's on this subject or any other subject that's out of the Bible, and we don't have any fear of reprisals at this point. But it may not always be that way. These people that lived in Russia, they were in their house. And this girl is right. She was 17 years old. One of the girls that was staying with the family, 17 years old, a vulnerable young woman. Soldiers came into their house every night at midnight. It's like it's almost clockwork. They didn't knock. They opened the door, walked in, and they had the flashlight, looked around, looked for trouble. Every night they did that. I mean, we don't have that kind of experience. We just don't. They couldn't lock the doors. If they did, they'd knock them down. So we have this time, we still have freedom. We have freedom. We feel some of the freedoms are lost, but in the general category of this thing, we are still free people. And we give the Lord credit for that. And we pray that it will continue, because that's what it says we should do in Peter. Lord, thank you for the evening and again for the joy we have being called your children. Lord, we realize that we are the sinners and we're the ones that cause all this trouble on this earth. Lord, without sin, the wonderful utopia that you have planned for us in the future already be here. But Lord, that's not the reality of things. The reality of things, we live in the sin-cursed earth, and we must deal with sinners like we are in this room. And for that, we thank you for the grace of God that causes us to be born again with a living hope, that causes us to be born again and to trust in your Son's salvation, death on the cross for our salvation. Help us, Lord, to be aware of the world we live in, be aware of the pressures that are there to undermine the things that you've clearly built into the human race, that how they should function in their responsibilities and our due diligence to serve you in filling the earth and subduing it and making it a place that you intended for mankind as you created Adam and Eve in the garden. Thank you, Lord, for our evening together. Bless now as we go to our homes. Keep us safe. And again, for the freedom we have in this country, we do thank you for the people that live in the Ukraine and other places around the world where there is persecution and the threat of danger. You give specially peace to the believers, as this lady wrote nearly 200 years ago, that she still have confidence in the midst of what seemed to be unbearable turmoil. So thank you, Lord, for the grace of God that makes that all possible. And Lord, we're the only ones who can claim that. And for that, we give you the praise. In Jesus' name, I pray it. Amen.